Well, I mean, I think the Bharatiya Janata Party took the initiative, as it were, and launched an attack on all Muslims. And Varun Gandhi, who was Indira Gandhi's grandson, actually threatened to drive out all Muslims and forcibly sterilize them and to cut them up and so on and so forth. And they were also very, I mean, this was just the most hysterical attack in a particular community, and it's an, you know, an example of very bad hate speech. But there were also very ugly things said by Mr. Advani, the prime ministerial candidate of the BJP against Prime Minister Manmohan Singh and so on. But there was also actually a lot of violence during the first phase, which was in the Naxalite-dominated areas, and then some of the Naxalite groups are opposed to elections in principle. And so there were some 17 people killed in the first phase. But things improved after that, and the election commission also took special steps to warn politicians that that hate speech would be punished, and such canvassing would be illegalized. So things improved somewhat, and so, we had a relatively peaceful election after that.
But how was it with all these candidates? I've seen you've mentioned in one of your articles that 16% of candidates have criminal records.
Right, right. And unfortunately, that remains the case even now. Many of those who've succeeded do have criminal records, and they're spread across many parties, including the Congress, and but a very high proportion of them are in parties like the Samajwadi Party, technically the Socialist Party, and the Bahujan Samaj Party. And that's a very unfortunate aspect of Indian democracy, that you have people with strong criminal backgrounds who can command, you know, goons to mobilize support for them, getting important positions in political parties. It's very, very unfortunate, yes.
Mr. Bidwai, these elections were not marked by any serious differences when it came to economic policies, foreign policies, distribution of goods, which is, of course, very important, especially in India, where 50% of children are still experiencing malnutrition. What was it about these elections, and how would you comment the results?
I think the results in some ways are quite encouraging. The BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party, which is a conservative Hindu chauvinist political formation, which was making a strong bid for power, got defeated. It lost more than 25 seats, and the Congress emphasized an inclusive brand of politics. In particular, it referred to the National Rural Employment Guarantee Act. This is an innovative scheme that provides 100 days of work per family in a year on public projects, public works project, at a guaranteed minimum wage. And that can make a difference between one meal and two meals a day for poor people. So that was a great success. Some 45 million households enlisted themselves under the scheme and gained some significant amounts of income. So, and that kind of that changed the image of the Congress during the campaign. Also, it had written off, its government had written off the loans taken out by farmers who had gone bankrupt because of high debts and crop failures and failure in particular of genetically modified cotton and so on. So that also helped the Congress claim that it was for a caring state, that it owes something to the poor, and I think that made a significant difference in states like Uttar Pradesh, which is huge, which is a population of 170 million, is the sixth largest territory in the world in terms of population, where a lot of poor people benefited. And there, where the Congress Party, which had been more or less moribund in Uttar Pradesh, was able to revive itself and emerge as the second largest party in the election. So these are important gains. I mean, it's a vote, a strong vote for inclusive politics, for people, for parties that care for the poor, and which practice secularism. I mean, that's an important issue. That was one thing because of which the BJP failed to make any headway, and in fact lost. Lost even in the areas where it had scored well earlier. Except for three pockets, it has done fairly badly and also dented its own image because of its sectarian and confrontationist campaign. Mm-hmm. So that is, I think, the setback to the BJP is a very positive thing. The endorsement of inclusive and secular politics is again a very positive thing. But and also, I think what we saw is that parties that were just playing on the politics of identity, in particular caste, without actually promising or doing anything to bring about substantive social and political change, did not do well. In particular, the party of Dalit leader Mayawati, the Bahujan Samaj Party, which rules in Uttar Pradesh, this very large state, failed to make any real advance. And so people want that. It's not that identity politics is dead. It's very important in a country where terrible discriminations and injustices exist, but it has to be accompanied by substantive change towards social change and transformation that really empowers the poor. So that's an important message that came across. And the last important message was for the left parties, the two communist parties and two other smaller parties which form a group which rules in West Bengal, which is a large and important state, and in Kerala in the south, and a small state called Tripura in the northeast. The left parties got a real bad drubbing in the elections, especially in West Bengal, because they've been practicing exactly the same neoliberal pro-free market policies that they criticized nationally. And over the last 3 years, there's been a very ugly confrontation over land acquisition for industrial projects, and people who don't want to part with the land were forced to do so. They protested, and the government, the police, opened fire on them in April 2007, killing 14 people in a place called Nandigram. And that land was being acquired for a huge chemical industry hub to be promoted by the Salim Group of Indonesia, which is actually a front for the super corrupt Suharto family. So public resentment against that was extremely strong. And the fact that the left front government killed 14 people, refused to acknowledge that it had committed a big blunder, it discredited the left front, and the left front got reduced to just 40% of its original size in the last election, from 61 seats to just 24 seats in this Lok Sabha, in this lower house of parliament. So this is a, you know, warning to the left that if it continues with those policies, which are really right-wing and conservative, and in favor of the rich and against the poor, then they will fall by the wayside. They'll, you know, go into the dustbin of history. So they must learn a lesson and change their political direction, their strategies, their industrial policy, their land acquisition methods. They must become more responsive to ordinary people. They must take their commitment to secularism more seriously. Now, you see, this is a government, incidentally, you may have heard of Taslima Nasreen, this Bangladeshi writer who was chased out of her country and took refuge in many countries of Europe and then finally in India. But the Left Front government drove her out of West Bengal because some radical Muslim fundamentalists didn't want her because she was critical of Muslim fundamentalism. And so that's also sent a very wrong signal. I mean, here's a government that was expected to defend civil liberties and the, you know, freedom of speech of an eminent writer like Taslima Nasreen. So there are many things that the Left Front government did which rankled, which angered people, and so it was punished very heavily. Some people might say even undeservedly, but the fact is it's a strong message that the left must change course. So I think these are various ideas, various positive things, and messages that come through in the election results, and I would consider them to be all very, very important and in many respects positive, and will help to create a better political system in India. The bad thing, of course, is that that Rahul Gandhi, son of Sonia Gandhi, performed very well. He was able to revive the Congress party in Uttar Pradesh, and this is seen as strengthening the dynasty, the Nehru Gandhi dynasty, which is not a good thing.
But if we stay a little bit with the left parties, India is one of the states in the world which has the lowest tax for the rich people. For who can replace in the political spectrum the left ideas which are anti-neoliberal in India?
I think. Well, I mean, there are. A very large number of social movements and civil society organizations which have done grassroots work to defend the livelihoods of the poor, which are under attack from predatory interests, whose land is being grabbed by mining and industrial projects, irrigation projects, who are fighting against enclaves being created for industry. At the expense of the taxpayer, special economic zones where there is no interest, where no taxes are charged, and all kinds of undeserved concessions are given. So these social movements do have a role, but they have to get into politics. But I think the biggest hope lies perhaps with the left parties reforming themselves, learning some lessons, rather than staying complacent. I mean, the Left Front has been in power in West Bengal for 32 years continuously. It's a world record in a democracy. But that has bred a lot of complacency, a lot of corruption. Party cadres have got working hand in league with vested interests, entrenched interests. They have, the party system has to be cleansed. The Left Front must do some serious rethinking, and especially of its strategy and industrial policy. I mean, the whole idea of promoting industry at any cost is utterly unacceptable. And I think if they learn that lesson, then they could actually play that anti-neoliberal role especially in a period where, you know, neoliberal capitalism is discredited throughout the world, and where people are looking for alternatives, where public intervention in the economy is considered acceptable. In the United States, they're talking even of nationalizing industries. And in India, there's a bit of a disconnect because the Indian elite hasn't suffered the same kind of effects of economic slowdown, of the global economic slowdown, as many countries in the West and, in fact, also in your part of the world have suffered. So they believe that they can still push through some more neoliberal policies, including privatization of pension funds and insurance companies and financial sector reforms, which actually could make India more vulnerable. Why India didn't suffer, in fact, is because most of our banks are publicly owned and well-regulated, well-capitalized, and we don't have capital account convertibility. So you can't take out money, you can't bring in unlimited amounts of money, and so that has actually helped India. It would be unfortunate if this lesson is erased and forgotten, and we practice the same bankrupt policies that the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund were advocating until recently. So we have a big agenda in terms of creating and perfecting alternatives, exploring approaches whereby regulation is tightened in the public interest and finance capital is brought under control. So and money that we need a huge transfer of resources in favor of the poor through redistribution policies, through higher taxation for the rich, for public works programs and public investment in productive industries and services. So that's the agenda that now faces us. Whether the Prime Minister, Manmohan Singh, who was very much a neoliberal, understands and respects this agenda and then works on it, is going to be very important. If he succumbs to the pressure of these lobbies which want neoliberal policies and free market approaches to continue, then we will lose the many gains that we have achieved. And but if the right lessons are drawn, then I think India could actually take a different course, which would be very, very good indeed.
There are a lot of parties in India that come from different castes. How have they helped in creating a society where all are equal?
Well, it's a long struggle because caste in India is centuries old, and it's very difficult to break down caste barriers and that those very systematic forms of discrimination, which find legitimacy in custom, in religion, and other kinds of hierarchical ways of thinking. But what has happened is that the oppressed and underprivileged castes have begun to assert themselves and are now demanding self-representation. They're saying it's not good enough that umbrella parties like the Congress represent us and further our interests. We want to be in power ourselves and do it. Now, some of these parties have gone overboard because they're just content with symbols of self-respect. I mean, that is what happened to the Bahujan Samaj Party. Mayawati, who's a remarkable leader in many respects, a great mobilizer, I think has spent more money on erecting statues to Dalit leaders, including herself, huge 50-foot-high statues, than on doing something substantive for the poor through land reforms, through redistributive policies, and so on and so forth. So these identity politics groups also have their limitations, which are being exposed now, and I think they have to rethink. Otherwise, they will stagnate and decline. It's going to be a long and hard fight, but what's good is that the fight has been joined.
Would you then say that India is the biggest democracy in the world in terms of numbers of people? Is it a success story, democracy in India?
It is, there are two aspects of democracy. There's the procedural aspects, you know, you have relatively free and fair elections and a fairly, moderate high rate of participation, unlike, say, in many countries in the West where the rich and the middle class don't vote. In India, where the rich and middle class vote, but the poor don't. But in India, it's the opposite. The poor vote in large numbers. So procedural democracy is good and healthy, but and it has also empowered a large number of people who had no place in public life. They are now were disenfranchised for a long time, and they are getting into public life, which is good. But substantive democracy, in terms of creating a real equality of rights and entitlements, leave alone equality of income or wealth, is very, very poorly developed in India. We still have terrible forms of discrimination against the religious minorities. For instance, Muslims have been rendered into second-class citizens in states like Gujarat, which saw a terrible massacre 7 years ago of 2,000 Muslims, right? Many other states, too, have seen that kind of discrimination. We need affirmative action programs for these minorities. We need a conscious attempt to actually create regional balances, economic and social balances. We need to have to redress inequalities. I mean, that agenda is very weak in this country, and the egalitarian perspective is very, very important. And I think people are beginning to realize that having high growth is no good, because that is not doesn't lead to eradication of poverty. It doesn't lead to employment. We had much higher rates of employment growth in periods of relatively low GDP growth. Now we have high GDP growth, but very poor employment generation. Now we need that. We need more jobs. We need more incomes for the poor. We need to control the rich and their runaway consumption. This is also related to the climate change agenda. India's greenhouse emissions are increasing rapidly. It's now the fourth largest emitter in the world because of the rich and the middle class. Now, they're having a great time, a huge consumption boom, and some of that will have to be controlled if we are going to cap our greenhouse gas emissions and have social justice along with growth. So I think this realization should have more scope to sink in, a more fertile ground now after this election. But there are also forces working in the opposite direction, which want to continue with the status quo, especially the conservative and inegalitarian part of the status quo. So we hope that these forces do not prevail.